Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk, given by Lama Kathy Wesley, is entitled, We All Will Live the Life of the Buddha. Reciting the prayer, Praising the 12 Deeds of the Buddha, helped Buddhists in former times remember their teacher's accomplishment and example. But we can also see our own lives as spiritual seekers reflected in the life of the Buddha and find hope in how our own life story mirrors his. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
So good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. And it's delightful to be here with you, especially after last week when we had to cancel because of the snow. And I want to thank everybody who tried to get here last week. And I'm sorry we were not here for you, but we will always be closed when the Franklin County Sheriff's Department issues a level 2 snow alert, just so you know that's the reasoning behind our not being here, because when a level 2 snow alert is given, this means that the Sheriff's Department feels that it is really unsafe to be out driving and that you should do your best to stay safe and at home. So we'll follow those instructions. So once again, thank you for being here, and thanks to our folks this morning on the morning team. Kim and Bill were on the early team, and then John's our tea guy. Who else is volunteering this morning? Who are our greeters this morning? Early morning greeters. Good morning, Ron. I think there was another morning greeter, but she's looking at her feet at the moment. So thank you, Roberta. You were on this morning. Were you on this morning? Okay, we'll give you some credit anyway. Thank you. Oh, okay. I think Patty was on this morning, actually. She was, yeah. Okay, so thanks to the morning team who makes it happen, and also to Connie for being our umze this morning. In the next few weeks, we're going to be engaging in our annual observance of the Tibetan New Year, which is pretty much at the same time as the Chinese Lunar New Year. So the Tibetan Lunar New Year this year is on Tuesday, February the 5th, and then the Sunday following that, February the 10th, will be our special Sunday observance of the New Year, or Losar. The first 15 days of the new year are astrologically significant in the Tibetan tradition of astrology because they commemorate the 15 days during which the Buddha, the historical Buddha, during his lifetime, performed a miracle every single day for 15 days in order to inspire his followers and also to win a debate. Now, isn't that a way to have a debate with a set of non-Buddhist scholars had challenged the Buddha Shakyamuni to a debate to see whose philosophy held up better under scrutiny. And so the Buddha Shakyamuni gave his, we will call them oral arguments, that he gave his philosophical teachings, and then as a way of completing his presentation, he performed a miracle each day for 15 days. And needless to say, what happened at the end was that he did win the debate. But the first 15 days of the Lunar New Year in this way are a commemoration of this. And in a way, it's a commemoration for all of us of our own Buddha potential. All of us, according to the teachings of the Buddha, all of us possess the potential to become Buddhas ourselves. All of us possess that potential. There may be days when our potential to become Buddhas is somewhat hidden from us. We might have some doubt about our Buddha potential. We might think, well, all those other people have Buddha potential, but not me. But the fact of the matter is, just as when the sun is behind the clouds, the sun is still shining. In that way, according to the teachings of the Buddha, in that way, our potential, our inner potential for wisdom, compassion, and goodness is present with us always. It never leaves us. And because this potential within us was uncreated, in other words, it's everlasting. It never was created by anyone in the past, and it cannot be destroyed. So uncreated, it cannot be destroyed, and is everlasting in that way. Our Buddha potential is with us always. It manifests for us as the world we see around us, the world of sight, sound, smells, touch, and so forth. But it also exists as our inner world of experience and thought, memory, and so on. But beneath all of that is the basic nature of mind, our Buddha nature, which shines like the sun and is all potential. Many people who have read Buddhist books know that the Buddha described our mind as being empty of limitation. Some people use the word emptiness. I preferred limitlessness. So our mind is empty of limitation. Our mind is not a solid object made of matter, atoms, or molecules. And yet it is not nothing because it knows, K-N-O-W-S, it knows and experiences. And so these two qualities of our mind, its basic limitlessness and vastness, and also its experiential capability taken together, are called our Buddha nature. And misunderstanding this, the sunlight of our Buddha nature is behind the clouds of our confusion and not knowing. And so it is the function of all Buddhist teaching to let us know about the presence of Buddha nature, to alert us to the presence of our Buddha nature, and then to encourage us to nurture and expand and uncover that Buddha nature. Everything from basic quiet sitting meditation, where we sit quietly and allow our thoughts and feelings and emotions to subside and rest through the practice of quiet sitting meditation, mindfulness. When we practice meditation and mindfulness, a lot of the chatter in our mind begins to quiet down. And as it quiets down, we can begin to see our inner goodness, our inner compassion, and our inner wisdom. And then we can begin to act upon that and expand our experience of it. So from the very first practice we learn as Buddhists, this quiet sitting meditation, we are gradually and thoroughly uncovering our Buddha nature. And all of the other practices, such as compassion meditation and mantra and visualization meditation, these are the three types of meditation taught at our center: quiet sitting, compassion meditation, and mantra or chant meditation. Those are the three styles that are taught here and the three styles that are practiced here. Each of those helps to calm the chatter of the mind and give rise to our inner qualities and characteristics. So I could probably go on about that, but the topic of today's lecture is something different. The topic of today's lecture is understanding the Buddha by understanding a prayer that praises the qualities of the Buddha. It's going to take me a second to find out where this is in the book. It's on page 40 of your red books. 40 is the beginning. It's a picture of the Buddha Shakyamuni, flanked by his two main disciples, Shariputra and Moggallana. Anybody lack a red book? We've got the red book department circulating among you. Jelaine is the red book department. Thank you. Thank you, Jelaine. Charlie, you need one, don't you? Can we get Charlie a neighbor? Can you look on with your neighbor? You may have to do that. Two thousand five hundred years ago, when Prince Siddhartha Gautama engaged in 6 long years of meditation, at the conclusion of his 6 long years of meditation, Prince Siddhartha Gautama attained a deep meditative state in which he saw the nature of his mind completely. And uncovering that nature of mind, he became Buddha, became the awakened one, awakened to his own nature. And then he began to teach others how to become awakened to their own nature, which is how Buddhism has lasted throughout this 2,500-year period from ancient India to now. I like to say about Buddhism that it's a positive path, because it talks about the positive potential in all beings. It says and teaches that all of us are basically good, because we have the potential to become Buddha. So our basic nature is basic goodness and wisdom. However, as we may notice from the behavior of individuals, ourselves and others, that Buddha nature is not always apparent, and that we can engage in much negativity, even though we possess Buddha nature. And so the path of the Buddha is to correct our misunderstanding about the nature of our minds and the world by showing us the potential that all beings have, which is why in some Asian countries, people will greet one another by pressing their palms together at their heart and bowing to one another. Because what they're bowing to is not the negative behavior of the other person or that the other person might exhibit, but they're bowing to the positive potential that is within that individual. And so wouldn't it be something if we could base all of our public relationships on this basic respect and basic acknowledgement of another's potential? In any case, this particular prayer that you see starting on page 41 is for many of us the first time we will have heard anything about the life and activities of the historical Buddha Shakyamuni. The reason I bring up the historical Buddha Shakyamuni is that his life story in some ways is like our life story. Think about it. Prince Siddhartha, his father was wealthy. His father was a landowner. His father had a kingdom. And he was set to inherit that kingdom. He was married at a young age because his father had heard a fortune teller say earlier in Prince Siddhartha's life that if this young prince is exposed to the sufferings of the world, he will leave his birthright as a prince behind. He will leave the kingdom behind and become a wandering holy man. Now, very few parents can imagine this as a career path for their youngster. Therefore, thinking that he would rather have his son become a prince than a wandering holy man, the king kept his son away from all external forms of suffering, hid him away in the palace compound, and gave him a very full life. His palace was everything to him. It was his entertainment. It was his athletic achievement. It was his school. It was his family. Everything took place within the walls of the palace. In fact, they figured that if they kept him busy enough, he would not have any inkling about the sufferings of the world, and not having any inkling about the sufferings of the world, he would be content in the palace and not leave to become a wandering holy man. And so in some ways, this palace that was Buddha, was the future Buddha, or Prince Siddhartha's prison of enjoyment, is very similar to what we experience today in our modern world. We let the record show for the recording that I'm holding up a smartphone. In some ways, we are also imprisoned in the palace of enjoyment and curiosity, beguiled by the interesting flickering images on the screens of our computers, iPads and tablets and so forth, that promise us happiness, that promise us an entry into a world that is actually an interior world, not an exterior world. Sorry to disappoint, but it's not an exterior world. It's an interior world of the mind. And so in some ways, we're just like Prince Siddhartha, beguiled by the images flickering on the screen, until something happens in our life, as it did to Prince Siddhartha, that shows us and exposes us to the sufferings of the world. Sometimes the exposure to the sufferings of the world happens in our own life. We experience a misfortune that is very difficult to cope with. Or maybe we see someone we love undergoing a misfortune. In whatever way we encounter suffering, we do encounter it. And sometimes it's more than our minds can contain. And we feel great sadness at the suffering we see. And so just like that, Prince Siddhartha, when he went on a journey to the four gates of his city with his chaperone, when he was trying to get his father to let him out of the palace compound, when he was allowed to go to the four gates of his city outside the palace to the four gates of the city, he saw four things that caused him great difficulty. The first was a person who was sick. The second was a person who had become aged. The last was a corpse. And the fourth one was a person meditating under a tree. The first three sights caused him great dismay. He said, "What is going on? I have never seen a sick person," because his father made sure that all sick people were removed from the palace. "What is happening here? I have never seen an aged person." That is because his father turned away all people who became aged. "What is this corpse? What is going on?" He had never seen a dead person in the 29 years of his life. Having encountered these three sights at three of the four gates of the city, Prince Siddhartha was completely overcome. "Do all of my people suffer like this?" he asked. And the answer was, "Well, yes, my prince, and you too shall suffer all of these things." This was almost more than his young mind could take. And when he saw the person sitting under the tree at the fourth gate of the city, he said, "What is that person doing?" And the chaperone said, "Oh, my prince, that person is meditating. They are attempting to go beyond the sufferings of this world." And this led to Prince Siddhartha's decision to leave the palace, to become a wandering holy man and to fulfill the prediction of the fortune teller who had spoken to his father so many years before. After 6 long years of meditation, Prince Siddhartha learned how to tame his mind, and in taming his mind, he saw and glimpsed his Buddha potential, and being able to meditate in that, all of the burdens and obstacles that had troubled him disappeared, and all of the walls and all of the barriers to his understanding the nature of his mind fell. And coming to this understanding, he experienced an internal illumination that today we call enlightenment or Buddhahood or awakening. Then he taught because he was requested to teach. It is said in legend that the Hindu gods, Brahma and Indra, asked him to teach. But whoever delivered the message, Prince Siddhartha, who was now the Buddha, began to teach. He taught for 45 years and wandered all over northern India and southern Nepal giving teachings. And many people followed him and became people who left home or became monastic. And those people who left home included his stepmother, who left with I guess you could call it the first women's march. 100 women marched with her to where the Buddha was residing, and they demanded to be ordained like the men had been ordained. And at first the Buddha hesitated, knowing that there would be many men who would leave the moment women came into the order. And after his initial hesitation, he granted them the capability of being ordained. And so in this way, the Buddha taught the equality of men and women. He taught the equality of low people and high people in society, because all have Buddha nature and all have the potential to awaken. And so these teachings then went from India to all parts of the world. You could say that the Buddha's final teaching was his death, because you see, many people were under the mistaken impression that Prince Siddhartha was actually a Hindu deity in disguise, an avatar or a manifestation of maybe Brahma or Vishnu or Shiva or one of the other great gods. But he denied this. They asked him which of the Hindu gods he represented, and he said none of them. And they asked him, well, are you an ordinary person? And he said, no, I'm an awakened person, meaning that he was a human who had attained awakening and therefore was free of being both an ordinary person and a divine one. And so with this last teaching, the Buddha manifested the signs of aging, he manifested the signs of illness, and he manifested the signs of death. And in so doing, he gave his final teaching to his disciples, saying to them, I have given you all of the teachings I need to give you. Now work on your own liberation from the sufferings of this world. Work on them with diligence. So after that, he asked that his remains be enshrined as relics in what were called chuten in Tibetan, or stupa in Sanskrit, or mounds that then became the first Buddhist monuments at the eight places of pilgrimage. And so the reason I'm telling you all of this is because these first 15 days of the upcoming new year are very good opportunities to reacquaint yourself with the life of the Buddha. Read any of the short abridgments of it that are available online. Meditate and make a commitment to yourself that you will try yourself to uncover your own Buddha nature, and that you will try to benefit others through doing that. And so this is the reason why we're talking about this prayer today, because this prayer reminds us that the Buddha was not some sort of anomaly that came from another planet or another place. He was just like us. And just like us, he was on the verge of being co-opted by samsara's pleasures and its sufferings. And he turned away from both of them, practiced an internal discipline that gave him liberation, and then taught others. So I read a wonderful article written by a Tibetan scholar who once said, all of us will live the life of the Buddha. All of us will be born in good circumstances, experience pleasure and pain, and then turn away from attachment to either one, and practice an internal discipline as the Buddha did, and practicing an internal discipline, we will become awakened just as he did. And so in a way, when we are reciting this life of the Buddha in this prayer, we're actually talking about our own potential as well. So thank you for listening to this short summary of the Buddhist holiday of the first 15 days of the Lunar New Year, the day of the celebrating the miracles of the Buddha. And now, if you don't mind, I'd like for us to engage in what we might call an interactive moment of reciting together in English this praise of the 12 deeds of the Buddha Shakyamuni. Some of it will make you laugh, but that's okay. We live in different times. It's quite all right. We'll start with he who is skillful. He who is skillful, compassionate, born in the lineage of the Shakyas, undefeatable by others, destroyer of Maras, and whose body is majestic like golden Mount Sumeru, king of the Shakyas, at his feet I prostrate. He who first developed the mind of enlightenment, then perfected the dual accumulations of merit and wisdom, and in this age perform vast enlightened deeds, and became the protector of beings. To him I offer praise. Having fulfilled the needs of gods, and having known the time to tame the human realm, he descended from the gods' realm, came in the form of an elephant, and seeing the lineage of Shakyas, entered the womb of Maya Devi. To him I prostrate. At the completion of 10 months, the son of the Shakyas was born in the auspicious garden of Lumbini. At that time, Brahma and Indra praised him and his excellent signs, ascertained him to be in the lineage of enlightenment. To him I prostrate. The powerful youth, the lion of men, exhibiting athletic skills at Anga and Magadha, defeated the arrogant competitors and became unchallengeable. To him I prostrate. In accordance with the worldly customs and to avoid calumny, he was accompanied by the retinue of queens. With skillful means he served the kingdom. To him I prostrate. By seeing that mundane activities have no essence, he left home and traveling through the sky near Namdog Stupa, he took the ordination of renunciation from himself. To him I prostrate. Intending to attain enlightenment by efforts, at the bank of Naranjana for 6 years he practiced asceticism. By perfecting perseverance, he attained supreme absorption. To him I prostrate. In order to perfect his efforts since beginningless time, at the foot of the Bodhi tree in Magadha, with unmoving cross-legged posture, by attaining the fully enlightened state, he perfected his enlightenment. To him I prostrate. Swiftly watching the beings with compassion, in the supreme places such as Varanasi, by turning the wheel of Dharma, he led beings into the three yanas. To him I prostrate. In order to defeat the other's evil opposition, he tamed the 6 heretical teachers, Devadatta and Mara, in the country of Kormojig. To the sage who conquered war, I prostrate. With virtues unequaled in the three worlds, he exhibited miracles in Shrasvasti and was worshipped by all the gods and human beings. He caused the doctrine to develop. To him I prostrate. In order to inspire lazy people to Dharma, in the clean land of Kushinagara, his Vajra-like immortal body passed away and attained nirvana. To him I prostrate. Since perfection is indestructible, and as the object of future beings to make merit, he manifested his remains with many ring cells and left them as the 8 types of reliquaries. To him I prostrate. When he, the chief of men, was born, took 7 steps on this great earth and proclaimed, I am supreme among beings in this world. To him, the great wise one of that time, I prostrate. He who first descended from the Tushita god's realm, entered his mother's womb in the royal state, and was born as the sage in the Lumbini garden, the blessed one, god of the gods, to him I prostrate. In the royal mansion, he who was worshipped by 8 nurses, among the Shakya youths, he demonstrated his athletic skill, and in Kapilavastu, he accepted Gopa in marriage. The unequaled body in the 3 worldly existences, to him I prostrate. He who showed sadness at the 4 gates of the city, cut off his hair at Namdog Stupa, and practiced asceticism at the bank of Naranjana, to him who is free from obscurations, I prostrate. In Rajgra, the sage subdued a mad elephant. In Vaishali, a monkey offered him honey, and in Magadha he attained enlightenment. To him who is shining with wisdom, I prostrate. At Varanasi, he turned the wheel of Dharma. At the Garden of Jeddah, he exhibited great miracles. At Kushinagara, he passed away into Nirvana. To him whose mind is like space, I prostrate. Thus, by the merit of praising the deeds of you, the Blessed One, the Master of the Doctrine, may the activities of all the beings also become equal to your deeds. May we all become very like the body of the Suchgon Buddha, and may we have retinues, life extent, Buddha field, and excellent signs similar to his. By the power of praying and offering praise to you, in the area where we are residing, may the sickness, poverty, and wars be pacified, and may Dharma and auspiciousness increase. May there be the auspiciousness of the longevity of the doctrine, with Buddhas appearing in the world, the doctrine shining like sunlight, and the development and prosperity of the doctrine holders, teachers, and disciples. Okay, thank you. I have to check in with the front office. What time am I to conclude today? My normal time? Okay, very good. Just had to check in. Sorry about that. I'm getting to the space. I don't know if anybody can relate. I have this gray hair on the top of my head, and I think it's interfering with my brain. So I kind of forget a few things, like what time am I supposed to end today? So thank you. So now we've covered a little bit about the life of the Buddha and read the praise of the 12 deeds, which if you have your magic cell phone with you, you can take a picture of and then read and study over the next week or so. But this is something that may give you some benefit as you begin to understand the accomplishment of the Buddha and also what we ourselves are also capable of accomplishing. So I think it's a good time for discussion. Because we record these Dharma talks for the benefit of our listening audience, we have maybe 10 people who listen online. No, how many people? We have a number of listenings, right?
We do.
It's in the hundreds. Okay, hundreds of that's from the IT office. Thank you. And so we have hundreds of people who look at our podcast. We have a question microphone here. And so if you wouldn't mind, you can, if anybody wants to make a comment or offer a question or whatever, you can get in line or have a seat over on that side of the room. And we can discuss whether any of the things in this prayer speak to you or whether they don't speak to you or whether you have a question about the meaning of certain things. I'm happy to address those with you. Discussion is always good. And we have a customer. Okay, very good.
Thank you, Lama Kathy.
Thank you.
It's such a pleasure to be here. Have a question. That came up during that. What does that mean in, I think it was Varanasi, turning the wheel of the Dharma?
The words, turning the wheel of Dharma?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
A little of this has to do with Indian traditions. And one of the traditions is that they think of the Dharma or truth as being sort of always true. And so the idea that it's circular, there's this circular image that's used for the truth. And the other image for the wheel is the ship's captain who takes us to the other shore of awakening. But there's also the Indian legend of the Chakravartin. The Chakravartin is, we might see certain parallels in other cultures of a monarch that is actually a righteous monarch that rules by law and is fair and loving and kind. So this idea of a benevolent monarch and who is very wise and perhaps even spiritually awakened and inclined. this is part of Indian culture, and that a lot of people looked at Prince Siddhartha after he became the Buddha and said, well, you know, he was born as a prince. I wonder if he's a Chakravartin. And chakra literally means wheel. And so the idea that he would be a truth-serving king. That's why they talk about. But there are other nuances as well. Then I would have to look those up and quote those to you from scholarly sources. But those are the nuances that I think of from my readings and teachings that I've attended. But there's more to be known about that, about the idea of what when we say turn the wheel of Dharma, that's basically what they mean, is like make this manifest in our world, make it operate in our world, make it part of our world. And it's really interesting. A lot of people have taken this to an interesting extent. In China, for example, books of Buddhist teachings were mounted on bookshelves that could actually be turned. In a symbolic way, turning the wheel of the teachings. Very interesting, yes?
Yeah.
Maybe it was just like our convenience racks in modern convenience stores where they put greeting cards and toys and things on things that revolve. I don't know. But
I like it.
But then there's also the Tibetan application of that, which is the prayer wheel. And you'll see frequently when you see pictures of Tibetan people who are circumambulating, which means they walk around a Buddhist monument or a Buddhist temple in a clockwise direction. They're sort of also enacting some type of wheel turning by turning the wheel of their own body, so to speak, around this. And so they will frequently hold in their hand a small wand that has at the top of this wand is a turning cylinder that has prayers inside that a counterweight is usually attached to that helps the spinning. And so a person will then turn the wheel of that mantra, which is a Dharma, around and around and around and around. And so you'll see a lot of people turning prayer wheels as a way of praying in a tangible way. There are prayer flags and prayer wheels. And so you'll see, and many people have told me that they know that they themselves may not teach the Dharma in this lifetime. They may not, but they can turn the wheel of Dharma by spinning their prayer wheel. Some folks like me are super lazy, and I only turn my prayer wheel when I'm doing something else. You might call me a workaholic, so it has to be useful. I can't just be walking down the street turning my prayer wheel. But when I'm watching television, which is usually either neutral or bad, depending on what you're watching and how angry it makes you. But anyhow, you know, I will run, do my prayer wheel when I'm watching television.
Great.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, thanks. Other things that people might want to comment on or talk about? Yes. Oh, yeah. I know.
Hi.
Hi.
I've got two questions. What are the six heretical teachers?
The six heretical teachers, I myself would probably not have used the word heretic if I were translating this. I don't know the Tibetan words. I don't know Tibetan vocabulary well enough to know what the alternate translations of those were. Right. But, you know, these modern days, I probably wouldn't have said that.
Right.
I would have called them... They're called Tirtikas in Sanskrit. And what the meaning of Tirtika is, since I didn't study, I skipped that day in school.
Right.
But they're essentially non-Buddhist teachers. Mm-hmm. And there were a number of other great teachers who arose at the same time as the Buddha, and they were teaching other things. And they basically challenged the Buddha, saying, well, you know, you're sort of the new kid on the block, and you've got all these followers, but we think there's something wrong with your philosophy, and we want to prove you wrong, so come and debate us, which was very common in India at that time. It was a very rich time for scholarship and debate, but he apparently won the debate. He tamed them.
Okay.
The other two who are named in this verse is Amara and Devadatta.
Right.
Devadatta was the cousin of the Buddha. Mm-hmm. And according to one of my Buddhist teachers, he was the only person the Buddha couldn't reach.
Right.
Because he was very arrogant and thought he was smarter than the Buddha. Mm. So the Buddha couldn't reach him with his teachings. And so Devadatta thought that he was smarter than the Buddha, so he would gather other followers around him and challenge the Buddha. And the Buddha, of course, was victorious, and Devadatta withdrew. Mm-hmm. But the idea is that he was able to conquer everyone, even Devadatta, but not necessarily with his teachings.
Right, right.
And then Mara, I got into a lengthy discussion with someone online this week about who Mara is and whether Buddhists believe in a devil or not. And interestingly enough, this is a big topic of discussion.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, those of you who are familiar with Denison University,
yes,
over in Granville, mm-hmm, they're actually putting on a symposium on this.
Really?
In 2 weeks, yeah, in the religion department. I'm going to go because I just can't turn away from a great topic like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Of Mara and Mammon.
Wow.
Which is comparing and contrasting Christian ideas of Satan and the devil,
right,
with the Buddhist idea of Mara,
mm-hmm,
which Mara is actually like is a name that's given to basically beings who want to prevent you from becoming enlightened, but they're not. Even Mara has Buddha nature.
Right.
So, you know, so the idea of Mara being a devilish character is like, I think it's more of a job description,
right,
than it is a person.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I mean, Satan was God's chief inquisitor before he fell.
Well, yeah, there you go.
He was a lawyer, but anyway.
Yeah. So anyway, but there's a lot that can be said about Mara. There are four types of Mara. These are four things that prevent us from getting enlightened. One is our kleshas, meaning our mental afflictions.
Right.
They keep us really busy.
Right.
And then we can't get enlightened because we're so busy.
Right.
And then the second is the Mara that is the askandas, meaning the Maras that are the components of our self-concept,
mm-hmm,
our body and you know, and thoughts and all of those things that make us think we have a separate self.
Right.
That stands in the way of enlightenment because we are so busy with those. And then the third Mara is the, you could call those the, and then the third Mara is the Mara that's death. That's, mm-hmm, going to really put a crimp in our ability to gain enlightenment, is,
yeah,
dying.
Death,
so you might
that.
Say that those three types of Mara are samsara.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last one is like nirvana, the, yeah, Mara of nirvana, which is the Mara of, called the Mara of the celestial child.
Right.
Which is the... which is clinging to the bliss of meditation,
right,
and not becoming enlightened as a result of that.
Right.
So
right.
Three Maras have to do with samsara and one with nirvana.
Okay.
Cool, huh?
Yeah. I have another question, but I can also sit down.
Yeah, let's see. Who else has a question? Let's see. If somebody else have a question? Curiosity? Yes, we have. Yes.
That's kind of like what I was looking for.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So is you wanted to know their names?
Yeah, I wanted to know who.
Have you got them? Do you actually like have them at your hand or?
Yeah.
Oh, the Pali version of their name. Go for it.
Yeah.
Go for it. Yeah. I mean, if you've got the reference, why not? Right. Because this will help the people who are watching the listening to the podcast. What book is this from, first of all, so they can look it up?
Majjhima Nikaya, Middle Length Discourses of the Sutras from the Pali translation.
Okay, the Middle Length Discourses of the Buddha. Okay.
Light reading,
yeah. Hey.
Purana Kassapa, number one.
Yeah, if you could get closer to the microphone, that'd help.
Purana Kassapa, he taught the doctrine of inaction. Makali Gosala was leader of a sect known as the Ajivakas. Ajita Kesa Kambalan was a moral nihilist.
Hmm.
Don't ask me to explain it.
Okay.
That's three. Paduka Kakayana advocated atomism on the basis which he repudiated the basic tenets of morality.
Hmm.
Sanjaya Belathaputta aseptic? I don't know what that
is. Ascetic or?
Septic, it says.
Oh, okay.
Refused to take a stand on crucial moral and philosophical issues. And the sixth, Nigantha Nataputta, historical progenitor of Jainism.
Okay, cool. Okay, thank you. That was, okay, now we have completeness. Thank you.
That's what I was looking for.
Okay, all right. Oh, I love this. It, you know, one of the things I like about community and having a community like this one is that when one person sneezes, the other has a tissue. So there you go.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions, curiosities, comments? Yes, okay.
I just wanted to know, what is this spear they're holding on the picture?
Oh, I see.
Like Catholic Church.
I see, yeah. The two figures, you're looking at the illustration of Buddha Shakyamuni flanked by his two disciples, and you're wondering what they are holding?
Yes.
In their outer hands, they are holding a staff that has, you can't see them here, but it has a Buddhist monument on the top, a stupa, which is representation of the Buddha's body, speech, and mind. But also, usually those staffs contain three metal rings that when jingling together make a jingling sound. And they are basically a call to all who may hear the sound that an alms gatherer is in, they are in the presence of an alms gatherer, that an alms gatherer is approaching, and that if they have alms or donations to give to that alms gatherer. So, and a renunciate, a person who has renounced hearth and home to live a wandering life, is approaching, and that they can honor that person's commitment by putting alms in the alms bowl, which is what they're holding in their other hand. So in their outer right hand, they're holding a jingling staff, and in their left hand, they're holding an alms bowl, which is also what the Buddha Shakyamuni is depicted as carrying in his left hand also. And it symbolizes their renunciate lifestyle. So does that do it? Okay. Yes. Hello.
This question relates to, in the text, if I heard correctly, the Shakyamuni manifested aging, sickness, and death. Mm-hmm. Let's put it that way. And that I've been thinking about this for a while. When I see our great teachers, our great gurus, Buddhas, it seems like, on the one hand, you know, my attitude is, why would they ever have sickness? You know, like His Holiness the 16th Karmapa, I understood he had cancer, and he didn't even take treatment, if I understood right.
He did take some treatments. He did take some treatments. And he was, in fact, in the United States. The 16th Karmapa was in the United States in Zion, Illinois, receiving cancer treatment at a cancer center that became one of the locations of cancer centers of America.
Did he take chemo?
So he was taking treatment, yeah.
Well, and then there's, you know, like Kempo Rinpoche had TB. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't seem to be particularly bothered by his aging condition. I'm just giving examples of people that I've had some encounters with. Bartar Tokul Rinpoche doesn't seem to be bothered by stroke. I mean, they don't seem particularly bothered by the sickness.
Right.
So when you in the text when it says when he manifested aging, sickness, death, are we is it correct to think that, well, he didn't really have to?
Yeah, I hear what you're saying.
The Tathagata that he could have.
Yeah.
He did it for our benefit, or what?
I hear what you're saying. I appreciate you pointing out this difference in language, because I think it is very interesting. It's very interesting that, yes, to us as students, we see them as perfect. And we see them as being beyond aging, sickness, and death. That's how we see them. And so out of that sense of devotion and respect, we will say things like, this perfect being manifested aging, sickness, and death. But the truth of the matter is, they are human. And because they have a human embodiment, they can't live forever. They only have a certain amount of time in that body, although it is said, and you can see this in Gampopa's Jewel Ornament of Liberation in the final chapter where he describes the powers of a Buddha. He said, technically, they can actually live as long as they want to. and that they will remain as long as they are needed. This is not necessarily something that all masters can do. They can't all stay as long as they want, but many of them can. The example that I can think of from the past is like Tilopa, who lived for more than 100 years. So because their body is actually human, it's not indestructible.
So I'm still a little in the dark about why it's phrased. The Tathagata, the Shakyamuni Buddha manifested these things.
Yeah, because I think it's because for us they are perfect, and so we have to find a way to say it that is in honor, that where we're still honoring what we think of them. Does that make sense?
Somewhat, but it seems like there's more to it.
Yeah, I'm sure there is. Maybe the thing to do is to think about this from the point of view of how we speak about people we love and care for, like our grandparents or beloved friends and so forth. We will frequently use nice words to describe even their faults. You know, we'll say that someone is a curmudgeon instead of saying they can sometimes have a bad attitude. You see what I'm saying? So we'll say nice things about them because it's a way of illustrating our honor for them. Does that make sense?
Yes, I think so.
And so naturally, we'll say about the Buddha, he manifested the signs of aging and death rather than saying, wow, he died.
Did he also show us maybe the enlightened way to sort of go through those things?
Absolutely.
Okay, I'm really good with that.
Okay, he absolutely showed us how to do it. He showed us how to live. He showed us how to benefit others, and he showed us how to leave this world. So, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, very good. We have time for one more. Is there one more? Oh, yes. Would you mind? Yeah. Yeah, thanks for using the mic. It helps us with the people listening. I love explaining the words, you know, because the words sometimes, especially the English translations, like, what's calumny, right? I know what it is. I looked it up, but it's a slander, by the way, just so you know. Okay.
In the area where we are residing, may the sickness, poverty, and wars be pacified. I'm kind of curious, since birth, old age, sickness, and death are part of life,
mm-hmm.
how do we mm-hmm. possibly pacify this even mm-hmm. for ourselves, let alone others?
Mm-hmm. I'm looking to see if the Tibetan helps me a little bit, because I'd like to be able to say it. Shiwa Dong. Yeah, okay. Shiwa is like pacify. The word in Tibetan, Shiwa, is mm-hmm. pacify. And it has the meaning of being able to quiet and comfort. It's like the idea of quieting and comforting. Oh. And so may the sickness, poverty, and wars be pacified. I think that the Dharma has the capability, and this is very similar to what we were talking about in the previous question. The Dharma, the teaching of the Buddha, and the blessings of awakened beings have the power to smooth all of those things for us so that we can use them rather than being sources of suffering and feeling like, oh, I'm being punished by this illness or I'm being punished by this situation. We can actually, we would actually then have the strength to see them as ways of purifying our karma instead of suffering from them. Does that make sense? It also is hoping for the pacification of warfare, which we could all use.
Yes, it just feels like such a tall aspiration.
Oh, right.
For that, by my humble practice.
Oh, yeah, okay.
That could I possibly benefit someone who is sick or dying?
I apologize for not answering, for not understanding your question, but now I understand your question. I apologize. I did misunderstand you. So basically, what this is that all of us have Buddha nature. We were talking about this earlier, and we had an early class today for the people who are doing the preliminaries. And we talked about the idea that everybody has Buddha nature, but at first, all we see is our defects. and we see our defects and we doubt our Buddha nature and our defects, we just kind of fixate on our defects saying, how could I possibly help anybody? But then the practice of Dharma slowly helps us to recognize that we do have potential. As for example, when we do shamatha meditation, we let go of our defects. We let go of our negative thoughts. We also let go of our positive thoughts, but we let go of all thoughts so that we get good at letting go. And that naturally makes us more capable of choosing good things over bad things. And so as we choose more good things over bad things, our recognition of the possibility of our Buddha nature gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Our recognition grows greater and greater. And as our recognition goes greater and greater, we learn meditation such as compassion meditation, where we model the behavior of being able to give happiness as we visualize that we give happiness to others with the out-breath, and compassion as we visualize in compassion meditation, taking on the sufferings of others with the in-breath. And so you see, slowly, our confidence in our Buddha nature and capability gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And then in mantra practice, when we imagine that we are Chenrezig, the Bodhisattva of compassion, and recite his mantra, Om Mani Padme Hung, and have that sense that all beings have been purified and transformed into Chenrezig, you can see the capability of seeing and living out and nurturing our Buddha nature gets greater and greater all the time. And so anytime we don't harm others, we've benefited them. We'll start there, right? So the first benefit we can do for others is not harming them, ditto, not harming ourselves. And the second thing that we can do for others is benefit them and take care of them, just as we can benefit and take care of ourselves. And the last thing we can do to benefit others is to tame our mind. And so, yeah, as Sitta Rinpoche once said, we have all these giant aspirations that we make. We make really giant aspirations. He says in Tibetan, we have a saying, when you're making an aspiration, don't think about practicality. Aim as high as you possibly can, because when you become a Buddha, then you'll actually be able, you'll have no obstacles to carrying those out. And that's why they say, aim high. No, yeah, because when you become a Buddha, you'll actually be able to do it. Now we can just imagine doing it.
Well, now we just trust that maybe if I am attending someone who's dying, that just because I have the aspiration and I have practiced and I have said some mantras, that maybe there's some sliver of help that could relieve their suffering and they could move on, whatever.
That's totally brilliant of you to say. That's absolutely, because that is exactly what it is.
Because it feels like at this point, I'm there, I'm present, I'm doing what I can, but I can't quantify if anything has helped.
That's right. Yeah. But
I just have to trust in
the power of virtue. You have to trust in the power of virtue. Because if you're sitting in the presence of another person and you're wishing them well, and you're working very hard to push to the edges of your mind any feelings or thoughts you might have of ill will against them, just push it all to the side and only think of the thoughts of goodwill. Wow. Wouldn't you want to be in the presence of such a person?
Well, I just feel like I walk away being blessed.
Yeah.
I have no idea to help them.
They brought out something good in you.
Yeah. I just feel like I'm enveloped in a bubble of peace, and I just hope it goes out to somebody.
Yeah. No, it's because it's
really, if I am helping someone.
I'm totally delighted that you shared this story with us, because it really shows you've illustrated your own life, that you feel blessed by holding virtuous thoughts. So like you're awesome.
Well, I do.
So it's like,
I just wonder if I'm like, it almost could be egoistic or selfish that,
of course,
that, if I don't hold the four views.
It's okay. It's okay. All virtue is beneficial.
Because I just feel, wow, I feel really blessed. I don't know if that helped them.
Yeah. All virtue is beneficial. Don't doubt it. The Buddha said it. All virtue is beneficial. Even if it's imperfect virtue, it's beneficial. Have no doubt about that, because you're not adding to the store of negativity in that room. You're adding to the store of positivity in that room. And the other person feels it in whatever way they are capable of feeling it. If their karma is such that they think that all people are bad, well, then they may not get what you're actually giving them, but they're getting something, even if you don't think so. Yeah. Thank you so much. All right. Yay. I'm so grateful to all of you for being here today. And we'll draw this to a conclusion by rejoicing in your Buddha nature. So I hope that this is not the first time that someone has told you you have Buddha nature. But if it is, I'm so happy to be part of this day when you hear for the first time you have Buddha nature. I will never forget the first day that Kempo Rinpoche told our group that you have within you a capacity to for goodness. You have within you a capacity for compassion and a capacity for wisdom. You have that within you, and no one can take it away. And that you have this, and if it becomes awakened, then it will astound you and amaze you. So thank you. So let's sit quietly and mentally dedicate the goodness of our session today. We dedicate the goodness of our session to all suffering beings. May all beings be free from their suffering, come to believe in their goodness, come to believe in their Buddha nature, and come to benefit all sentient beings endlessly. We'll mentally dedicate the goodness with this thought in mind. Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.